You are listening to the NHRD podcast. NHRD, a national HRD network, India's largest network for HR professionals.
Good to have you join us on the NHRD podcast. I'm Sheetal, and today we're about to bring you a conversation that sits at the intersection of leadership, of people, and certainly of organizational resilience. Now, what does this have to do with you? Well, there are lessons in each of these areas that will come to you, because the person who we have joining us has done all of this, has led through periods that have required organizational resilience. He has interacted with people. In fact, his book is dotted with experiences and achievements of regular people like you and I who work in organizations. That really stood out for me, but I'll come to that a little later. The person joining us on the conversation today is Suresh Narayanan. He is the former chairman and managing director of Nestle India. And some of you will remember that the organization in the mid-2015 or so, at that time, went through arguably one of the worst crises that an FMCG brand has ever faced in India. We all remember the Maggi crisis. We read about it in the newspapers. But that's not the only thing that Suresh has actually steered his organization through. He's been part of the Arab Spring situation that panned out at a certain point in our history. He's also been part of the whole Lehman Brothers induced financial collapse of 2008. COVID, of course, all of these have been part of his journey as not just a professional, but as a human being as well. And I think that human lesson is what has been distilled into Courage Under Fire. With this book, he turns an author. Thank you so much, Suresh, for joining us on the NHRD podcast. How are you doing today?
Thank you, Sheetal. Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. And I'm keenly looking forward to talking to you about the book and more.
Yeah, but the book and more. But we'll start with the book, Suresh, because here I was thinking, right? A lot of people have learnings and experiences, etc. And we have, in fact, in the corporate lexicon, we have very nice phrases for this: institutional memory, knowledge transfer, experience sharing. But not a lot of these stories really actually come out, certainly not in the form of a book. And I've wondered whether it's actually about courage, you know, whether people just don't are more concerned about the optics of it rather than the impact. Is that what keeps them, and what inspired you then to put pen to paper?
See, Sheetal, for me, this has been a reasonably long project.
Yeah.
And one of my desires has been that at the end of my corporate career, to put down a set of perspectives that I could share with young leaders, with not so young leaders, with aspiring leaders, on an aspect that is seldom given the kind of focus that it should, which is issues around people, around purpose, values, culture, behaviors, and about ethics, humility, hard work, all the simple things that we have been nurtured with when we were young. This is what our parents taught us, and this is what our education gave us. And really to focus on the software aspects of leading teams. And the scenario I chose was more around crises, because crisis for me is that one template that tests the character of the people around you. And therefore, I thought I would leave these as perspectives, not as prescriptions. I am not egotistical enough to put them down as prescriptions, but more as perspectives that leaders can look at in an age that is now becoming very, very transactional.
Yeah.
From being almost paternalistic to now being transactional is the extreme that we are seeing in leadership. And really to define the watermark and saying this far and no further.
Yeah. I went through the book. I read it actually over the weekend. And what actually stood out for me is that, and I'm sure for our viewers, when you get hold of the book and read it, you will also be pleased to see it's dotted with the references to popular culture, whether it is Leo Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, it's Tagore, it's Kabir. You're talking about Red Moon and, you know, the phrase itself, Courage Under Fire. There is so much in the book. Roger Federer makes it. There is Stephen King as well. Can you believe it? I mean, all of that is there in the book. But what stood out, it's got regular people. You will learn of, Simar. You will learn of Sonia's story, Mustafa Hussain. You will learn of Pratik. There is Balaji. You will even find a reference to Chidambaram, who was part of the union. Very interesting story over there, but we'll come to that. It's dotted with references that will resonate, not just for people who read and watch popular culture, but also one of us indeed, right? So that stood. What was even more interesting is that Suresh, sort of clairvoyant in many ways, I think, has a section dedicated to Gen Z. It's part of a larger narrative. And today, Gen Z is a phrase that everybody, even if you didn't know, you know, Gen X, Y, Z, etc., you are talking about it. And I wanted to come to that very important reality that we're in the middle of right now, Suresh, because let's not go there, but we do need to go to the fact that youth, in many ways, are similar across time, right? What is the common thread that ties youth across all time? Aspirations, how they experience things, etc., in your view?
See, it is, I think you've hit the nail on the head, Sheetal. For me, it is a gap between aspirations and reality. I think no youth, I believe, or no, when we were young, we were aspirational, we were idealistic. We looked at life with rose-tinted lenses. And we looked at the best outcomes or sought the best outcomes to happen to us as a result of our education. We are also part of a culture where parents, where relatives, where obedience is an important aspect, irrespective of the generation. Maybe the intensity has changed, but the essential concepts still remain the same. Today's youth, I feel, are stressed by different situations. One is by the peer group pressure that they face. I'm not a critique of social media, but I think the role that social media has played in seeking false aspirations or false promises that people want to live themselves up to is becoming an issue for them. The chasm between education, employability, and employment is becoming an issue for them. You know, where else would you have for a million people applying for 30,000 jobs, right? Where else would you have examinations as difficult as NEET and as IIT? And indeed, not all of them make the cut. So there is this gap between aspiration and reality that is leading to a lot of dissatisfaction. And on top of that, we have the specter of technology, you know, the whole AI, which is an elephant in the room,
right.
We don't know how far it is going to go and how many roles and jobs it is going to swallow. And in that situation, the sheer anxiety to make a living and yet to have a life is an important concern of Gen Zs. And that is why I feel that the role of leaders is to become more what I call the model of servant leadership,
right,
which is not leading with a go-go-go attitude, but leading more with guidance, with mentorship, with coaching, with putting a hand around people's shoulders and getting them to do the work, rather than being brutalistic,
right,
in the way in which we approach work and life. And I think that is the core theme of what I sought to exemplify in my career, a concern for people, a concern for different generations, and a concern for trying to meet, wherever possible, the chasm between aspiration and reality.
Clearly, one perhaps assumes that one has to alter leadership styles based on a generational mix that you might have in the organization, or even a cultural mix. You've, Suresh, led in multiple geographies. Is there something different about the way Indians either lead or like to be led that you have experienced in your career?
Look, I think one of the things important, Sheetal, in anybody who's seeking a global career or an international career, is to first be interested in people and cultures. many of the opportunities are given to what are deemed to be the most competent hotshots.
Right.
But they may not be the most amenable people to different cultures and adapting to different cultures. So for me, that's an essential aspect. And somehow, having moved around India with my father, I got to appreciate different cultures, you know, from Andaman and Nicobar to the Northeast to Uttarakhand, you know, to different parts of the country.
Right.
So that gave me a sense about the multicultural nature of our country itself,
right.
You know, even before I traveled overseas. I think there are two things which are important in adapting to different cultures. One is to understand that people, wherever they are the same.
Hmm.
Right? Their motivations are the same. To have a healthy life, to have a happy life, to have a valued profession, to be recognized, to be rewarded, to be given opportunities is an essential across cultures.
Right.
And the second principle that I've always tried to use is understand before being understood.
Hmm.
I think that's a lesson not only in absorption, but also in humility. For Indians, what we tend to sometimes do, and this is not to stereotype people, so there could be many, many people who might say that, look, this is not what people in my organization represent. But by and large, you find that Indians tend to stereotype behaviors and attitudes and tend to go with what they see as the prevailing idiom on a particular culture. And they try and make comparisons vis-a-vis the Indian culture.
Right.
In India, you know, I think if you go towards the Southeast Asia, for example, being gentle in words and deeds and also being respectful of keeping the face is a very important aspect. So you may disagree with someone in a meeting and you may be the superior, but it's always better for you to politely call him to your room or her afterwards and have a discussion,
right,
rather than confront them in the room. Whereas we are by nature combative. We like to combat. And in some cultures, it does not work because it's immediately taken as a sign of being insulting or being arrogant. And sometimes leadership is derailed not because of a lack of competence and understanding of the business. It is because of the nuancing of body language, the tone of language, and also the manner in which you speak and understand that makes a difference. And that's when you get into a vicious circle where inappropriate actions, inappropriate use of words leads to your colleagues feeling a little bit bottled in by your attitude and therefore not responding strong enough and therefore your results not being strong enough, and then you
right.
get into. So the same guy who was a high performer
right.
in one context suddenly becomes a question mark in a different cultural context.
Yeah, understood. And speaking of, you know, cultural context, organizational culture, there are so many frameworks that you see in organizations, all well-intentioned, right? The idea is to give people some sort of a set of beacons to sort of model themselves on. So there are words like, you know, excellence, innovation, agility, bias for action, etc. And these are put down on paper, and sometimes we find organizations struggling to get people to behave in those ways. So you have entire initiatives, competency framework, XYZ, and there are fancy names given. But in your experience, is there a simpler way of just inspiring people into action, Suresh?
Look, I think Sheetal, that's a very good question, and pardon my being a little provocative on this issue. I've found over the years that nobody but nobody at any level in the organization is inspired to work for an organization that will grow from 20 billion to 40 billion. And that is the ambition, right? Our ambition is to grow from 20 billion to 40 billion, and all of you therefore must charge ahead and must sweat and must do the task that is meant to be done. People are inspired by purpose and causes. People are not inspired by pure numbers. So if, like in Nestle, we used to talk about not only providing food and nutrition for this generation, but for generations to come,
right,
it's a much stronger evocation of the spirit of the organization. So I honestly believe that all the time and effort that we spend in putting out long mission statements, vision statements, and commitment statements can be easily truncated by just focusing on who we are, what we are, why are we who we are, and where do we get to be.
Right.
Yeah. And I think to exemplify it as simply as possible, you know, I've always believed in one thing, Sheetal, that whatever I communicate, whatever strategies we put together as a team should be comprehensible by the least common denominator in the company. Since I've worked in an FMCG, the frontline salesman should be able to understand exactly what the company is seeking to do. And that is when alignment happens, that is when action happens, that is when commitment happens. So really, the process can be simplified by focusing on purpose, values, behaviors, and consequences that you want this to lead to. And once you do that, I've always believed, and by the grace of God, I have happened to run corporations which have also been successful. I think these are not philosophic issues. These are core issues. I think what we do is, if something cannot be measured with a KPI, we think that this is a soft issue.
Right.
Building a culture is a tough issue, is a hard issue. It is an everyday, every hour task. It's unlike reviewing KPIs and saying, okay, done, not done. So in that context, I think there is a feeling that I have is that organizations are spending far too much time on the strategy piece rather than on the culture execution piece.
Right.
And that's why companies are not failing because of lousy strategies. Some of them do, but most of them don't fail because of lousy strategies. They fail because of lousy leadership, guidance, and culture. And that makes a significant impact not only on the generation there today, but on the future generations of the organization.
Yeah. And that brings me to something that in your book, that line, that phrase stayed with me. Leadership is about how, not about all of these other things that are also part of that whole territory, but it's also about how people experience you, right? And that
yes.
The end in my head is like culture. You experience great culture. You've had people count on you, believe in you, trust you. And you also made the distinction, leaders need not be loved, but they certainly need to be trusted. What are the pointers that you will give to leaders who are trying to build a culture? Because, oh my God, how does one build culture in an organization? What does one do?
Look, I think, it's a very vast topic, Sheetal, and I'm not the certified expert on it. But a few things that have served me well in my own career. Number one is believe in yourself and in your authenticity. I think authentic leadership is far more important than structured leadership.
Right.
In structured leadership, you try and structure objectives, vision, you try and structure your behaviors, you try and structure your actions and outcomes to a particular template that you think you're going to follow. I believe in authentic leadership. Authentic leadership means walking the talk and talking the walk, both. That you deliver what you promise and you promise what you can deliver. I think that authenticity, when it comes in, a few things happen. Number one is the lubricant for the organization in terms of actions and in terms of direction is set.
Right.
The clarity of the organization is much sharper. And the calmness with which the organization approaches difficult situations is much better and much more well-defined.
Right.
As compared to a leadership that is erratic and a leadership that is all over the place.
Right.
So I think authentic leadership, a strong focus on purpose and values, a strong definition of accepted behaviors and not accepted behaviors, and a very clear enunciation of the outcomes built for strong cultures. And this repeated over a period of time. You know, culture, I've always defined it, is the language that is spoken when no one is watching. Because when everybody is watching, you're at your best behavior.
Right.
But when the chips are down and when nobody is watching is when culture actually counts.
Yeah.
Culture gets built up. Authenticity gets built up in good times.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't suddenly start building a culture in a crisis. That's when you reap the benefits. You harvest the benefits of a good culture.
One thing that I took away from the book, right, through it all, I found that whatever the crisis was, communication, you kept bringing up the idea, or maybe as a communicator, that's the word that I caught on to and held on to, saying, see, he said communication is important. Did it ever feel, Suresh, that it is dangerous to communicate too much when, you know, things are in a state of flux? Did any of these moments, especially the Maggie crisis, for example, feel insurvivable when you were inside of it and you thought that no matter what I say, it's going to be a pickle?
No, Sheetal, I think that dilemma every leader faces for two reasons. One is because of the environment that is prevalent, the legal frameworks that are defined.
Right.
So there are some things that you can say and some things that you cannot say, and that gets defined by a corporate's own stance that it takes. And secondly, is to be able to judge the use of words and the tone of words in a difficult situation.
Right.
And I think one is a question of a framework that gets defined for you. The other one is a question of your own judgment and your own style.
Right.
And I think one of the things that I've always believed in is that when your back is straight, you don't have to bend. It's only when your back is not straight, when you've done something that is illegal, or you've done something and you're trying to obfuscate it,
right,
that you have to find all kinds of means of trying to deny it. In the Maggie crisis, we honestly had done nothing.
Hmm.
Right? Every test, every analysis that was done subsequently was shown to be crystal clear as far as the product is concerned. So when I had a spinal cord as strong with the company's compliance on quality and safety, I had nothing to fear.
Right.
The question was only not trying to run ahead of myself or try to run ahead of what the consumer would be able to absorb in bite-sized pieces and not in large chunks. And that's really, sometimes when you think you're in the right, you tend to become a little bit arrogant about it. And arrogance is probably, you know, and that hubris is probably the downfall of many corporates.
Yeah.
Right? You may not be wrong,
yeah,
but the way in which you convey it, thumping the table and all guns blazing, is showing the person that you are putting them down.
Right.
And nobody but nobody, even the most humble human being, doesn't like to be put down. And that's something that you have to understand in dealing with the environment.
Yeah.
This concludes part one of our conversation with Suresh Narayanan on the NHRD podcast. Join us in part two as we continue the conversation. You are listening to the NHRD podcast. NHRD, a national HRD network, India's largest network for HR professionals.